Let me begin by saying a couple of comments about the new report. I think there's no doubt that for those of us who have worked on the Iranian issue for many years, it comes as something of a earthquake. After many years of bilateral U.S.-Israeli consultation on this issue, this is certainly a major change in the whole issue, something which potentially has overwhelming strategic importance for Israel, maybe somewhat less for the United States, but also a great deal of importance for the U.S. as well. Now, I would like to add a cautionary word in the sense that the report itself indicates that there is some disagreement on the United States side within the intelligence community. We have yet to hear the Israeli response to this. And on the one hand, one might think that if the information that the report is based on was sufficiently good to convince the U.S. government, then it should, in all likelihood, be sufficient to convince the Israeli government. At the same time, Israel does take a more worst-case approach to this, and it may have greater questions. On the other hand, good news is good news, and there is at least an indication of that. I think this is in many ways a vindication for those who have supported the hardline approach towards Iran over the years, for those who said that if sufficient pressure was exerted on Iran, it could bring about the desirable outcome. And to the extent that this report proves to be correct, that is a happy outcome for all involved. And needless to say, all parties hoped for and hope today that there will be a diplomatic resolution to the issue. Well, this provides us more time to explore the diplomatic route. Unlike some of the initial reactions to the study, I did not advocate military action. I didn't advocate action of any sort. I advocated talking about the options. Well, the good news that comes out of this report is that we now have more time to talk about the diplomatic route, and that we may have more time to then discuss the other possible options to the extent that the diplomatic route does not appear to be successful, if it doesn't in the future. The study itself, of course, is based on the assumptions that predate the NIE, and my talk today as well will also focus on what we thought to be true, at least until yesterday. It has been repeatedly said, it has become almost something of a mantra, that Iran represents an existential threat to Israel. Israeli leaders have repeated this constantly. American leaders have repeated this. The president has spoken of World War III as a consequence of the Iranian threat to Israel. Under those circumstances, I think any reasonable person would presume that two countries which are as close as the United States and Israel, which have such a unique relationship, the special relationship, would have been conducting a deep and broad dialogue on the Iranian nuclear threat for many years now. And if we look at the public record, indeed there is indication that there has been a broad exchange of intelligence information and that there's been a broad exchange of ongoing diplomatic information in the sense of what is happening this week or next week in the Security Council or the IAEA. But if we look at the public record, there is no indication that there has been a policy-focused discussion. In other words, what the options for separate or joint action might be. There is no indication that the sides have discussed the possible issues of military action or the alternatives to military action, how one lives with a nuclear Iran once the ability has been achieved. There's an old expression in Hebrew that a monologue in Israel consists of one person talking to themselves, whereas an Israeli dialogue consists of two people talking to themselves. And the question is whether what we have here between the U.S. and Israel is an Israeli-style dialogue. Well, the question is if, in effect, we don't have a true policy dialogue underway, why this might be the case, what the obstacles to open and free dialogue are, and how might one get about these obstacles. What should we be talking about, and how do we get about the obstacles? This was the focus of the study. And I want to also say that it's not really quite as surprising, it may be counterintuitive, but it's not really surprising that there may be such obstacles to a true and open dialogue of this nature. You only have to look, for example, at Churchill's memoirs of World War II to see his frustration over Washington's lack of willingness to really tell him what U.S. policy was. And if the U.S. and British had trouble talking during World War II of putting their cards on the table, then it's not surprising that this might be the case of U.S. and Israel as well. Sovereign nations are loath to put their cards on the table to really open up and say what they think on such sensitive issues. Shortly after the war in Iraq, I had the opportunity to be in a meeting with a senior British official who, in the way that only the British can, in a magnificent British accent, said that the U.S.-British dialogue preceding the war was akin to being an ant riding near the anus of a raging rhino. And I thought to myself at the time and had the audacity or stupidity to say to the British, well, we also have a special relationship with the United States. If you guys were near the anus, where does that put us? I will leave you with that thought without further developing it. I think there's a tendency on the part of most Americans who hear about this issue, maybe Israelis as well, to presume that the obstacles to dialogue are on the Israeli side. And I would submit to you, and you will then hear this when I now get into the substance of the talk, that the obstacles are probably at least as great on the American side. Certainly similar. Until now, until the NIE, I believe that the two sides shared a common assessment of the problem, of the threat, what Iran's nuclear program means for the region, for Israel specifically, for American national security interests, both regional and global. Both sides seem to have taken an approach which was something like a worst-case scenario was approximately 3 years, and the outer assessments were more towards 8 years. Okay, this is now all in question with yesterday's publication. But if the technological assessments and the strategic assessments were similar, very similar, there was also a fundamental asymmetry in that for Israel, the Iranian threat does pose a potentially existential threat, a threat to the nation's very existence. For the United States, there's no doubt that Iran is a major national security concern, one of the preeminent issues that are of concern to the administration. It is by no means an existential threat for the United States. And thus, the two countries approach this from a different position. I also think the U.S. would probably take a broader approach towards a resolution of the issue than Israel. That is not to say, for example, that Israel isn't very concerned by Iran's missile program, by its potential WMD programs in other areas, by its role in promoting terror in the region and in trying to thwart and defeat the peace process. Israel is, of course, very concerned. I think, however, that the Israeli approach, or by Iranian involvement in Iraq, I think the Israeli approach is so colored by the threat perception, by the nuclear threat, that Israel would probably be willing to swallow any resolution of the issue that dealt with the nuclear issue, put at the expense of the others, put them aside, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. I'm not sure that the U.S. could take that approach, certainly regard Iranian involvement in Iraq and possibly the terror and peace process issues as well. Well, what are the issues for dialogue? The first stage is, of course, the diplomatic dialogue. Preventative diplomacy combined with sanctions. On this issue, on this level, I don't think there are any major problems to open dialogue. Both sides would greatly welcome a diplomatic resolution, are already engaged in a deep dialogue, discussion of these issues. No real problems, except for maybe one, which can be handled as well. Israel would probably like the U.S. at some point to commit to a definition of what failure of the diplomatic process means. At what point the U.S. will decide that the diplomatic / sanctions effort has run its course, and it's now time to explore the other options. The U.S. will probably be hesitant to give a a commitment to make a clear definition of what this constitutes. Another level of dialogue might be on quasi-military operations. For example, a naval blockade. Israel would actually have no role of consequence in this, would want to be informed by the U.S. I don't think there's any problems to talk about that. Israel has no role. I don't think the U.S. would have a problem talking about this to Israel. The problem in dialogue arises when you start getting down the route, and the issue of military options arises, whether it's an American, an Israeli, a combined, a multinational operation, whatever it is. Then you start getting into the really difficult areas. Let's say that Israel believes that it does have an effective military option, and I'm not going to get into what effective means, but let's say Israel believes that it does have an effective option. Well, do you then come and talk to the United States about this? I think one of the main issues that any Israeli prime minister would ask himself is, well, am I assured of the answer that I want? And if I'm not assured of getting the answer I want, maybe I better not pose the question. I risk an American veto. And to go and do something over an American veto is very, very hard. Not impossible, but very, very hard. There might be a fear that it would be leaked on the American side, unintentionally or intentionally, to make it harder for Israel to do so. Israel, I would imagine, would prefer, if somebody is going to act militarily, well, the United States clearly has a greater capability to do it than Israel does. The U.S. has global reach, can put ordnance basically on any coordinate in the world. So the chances of a successful American operation, just by virtue of difference in size of military capabilities, from an operational point of view, would be preferable for the United States to do it. Is Israel going to say that it's going to do it and then relieve, or then the U.S. is relieved of the pressure to do it itself? So if Israel has the capability, it would probably be hesitant to come and talk about this in Washington. If Israel doesn't have the capability, well, if you come and tell the United States that, then you again remove the pressure from the international community, from the United States, to deal with the issue effectively. So again, I would imagine that Israel would be hesitant to share this. Well, let's say on the U.S. side, I don't think there's any doubt that the United States has an operational capability to hit the targets. That's not the question. The question is how effective it can be, if it's long-term, if you know where all the targets are. The U.S. can reach any area on the earth. So there is an American capability. Well, will the U.S. want to talk to Israel about this? I think that any president would be hesitant to make this kind of far-reaching commitment to any foreign leader, especially given the current circumstances around Iraq. It's an electoral year. It makes things particularly difficult, but under any circumstances, countries don't like to make that kind of commitment. This is, of course, I'm not addressing the issue of whether either Israel or the U.S. will give advance warning at the last moment. That I think is pretty obvious. You'd basically have to. But I'm talking about truly advanced notification, strategic coordination here. Well, let's say the U.S. decides that it doesn't have an effective option, or decides that maybe it does, but it's not going to use it. Does the U.S. then decide to come and present this to Israel as well? Say, you know, we just want you to know we're not going to do it. Again, I think the U.S. would be quite hesitant to do so, because maybe that just gives Israel the justification for going and launching an independent action of its own. There are those who say that Israel should actually just go ahead and attack without asking for permission, because the U.S. will really have little choice but to support it post facto in any event. What can the U.S. do when Israel has acted in its time of extremis, when the U.S. itself was not willing to deal with the issue? There are those who raise the possibility that actually the U.S. would be quite happy to see Israel go ahead and do it. Might not be able to say so publicly, but quietly. It would relieve the U.S. of the burden of dealing with the issue. Might solve it. Well, what might a military operation be designed to do? This is, again, something that the sides would have to hopefully want to discuss. And I think the shared objective would probably be, at least the bare minimum would be a few-year delay in the Iranian program? What constitutes a few years which are sufficient? What is the precise dividing line? I don't know. I imagine if somebody said, well, we're only going to achieve a one-year delay, that's probably not worth it. If somebody said a 10-year delay, that probably is worth it. Where exactly the threshold is hard to define. A second point is that I presume the sides would want to make it clear to Iran that any attempts to reconstitute the program after the initial attack would be futile because they would be attacked again and again as many times as necessary to prevent its reconstitution. I would imagine that the two sides would like to use the time gained to institute some sort of international regime which would make it that much harder for the Iranians to reconstitute the program, not just warn them, but make it harder through an international regime. And lastly, there would be the hope, I don't think it would be more than a hope, but there would be a hope that the time gained would increase the probability of regime change internally, for domestic reasons, within Iran itself. Well, let's say that the sides then come to the conclusion that there either is no military option or that they don't wish to exercise it. That then leaves one with a number of options for how do you live with a nuclear Iran? And again, I think that there are obstacles on both sides to talking about that. I think Israel would be very hesitant to talk, certainly at this stage, putting aside the NIE, to talk about how to live with a nuclear Iran, because that in itself might be viewed by the U.S. as Israeli willingness to countenance the very thought of not ending the program by whatever means. But by the very willingness to discuss the issue, Israel might be viewed as signaling a willingness to countenance this possibility, and that is clearly something that Israel does not wish to do, certainly at this point. Israel might be concerned that the U.S. would then be more willing to focus on containment and deterrence rather than elimination of the program. And because of the asymmetry in the two sides' perceptions here, for Israel as an existential threat, the Iranian program is something which is viewed as that which must be eliminated. For the U.S., the possibility of containment and deterrence is certainly a more amenable possibility, not necessarily a preferable one, but clearly the U.S. could look at that more favorably than Israel. Again, the United States, if the issue was put on the table, might be concerned that Israel would interpret American interest in talking about this as an indication that the U.S. really intends to pursue this route of containment and deterrence and not pursue the route of eliminating the threat, and that Israel, under those circumstances, might then decide that it really has to go the elimination route on its own. And also, if you're going to live with a nuclear Iran, well, how do you do so? One of the options, and I'll mention this again in a minute, is, for example, an end to the Israeli policy of nuclear ambiguity. Well, I'm not convinced that the U.S. wants to talk about, I'm certainly not convinced that Israel wants to, I'm not convinced that the U.S. wants to discuss that option at all. So better not even put the whole subject of how to live with a nuclear Iran on the table. Well, what then are the options for living with a nuclear Iran? Well, one range of options is from a unilateral American declaration of a deterrent declaration to warn the Iranians off. This can be Israel-specific. It can be a general statement regarding American support of nations in the Middle East subject to either an Iranian or just any nuclear threat. And it can range from this kind of general commitment all the way, of course, to a specific American security guarantee for Israel. And then the idea would be that the United States would be bestowing extended deterrence, as it's called, to Israel. You take Israel's own independent capabilities, add it to the American guarantee, and this would certainly be a step in the direction of deterring Iran. Well, I think that really most countries in the world believe that there already is a de facto U.S. Commitment to Israel's security. I think most Israelis believe so. I think the Arab states believe so, Iran. I'm not sure that formalizing this in any document makes a substantive difference. It certainly doesn't hurt, but I'm not sure that it makes much of a difference in real terms. Israel, for the most part, over the years, has not wanted a formal American security guarantee for a variety of reasons, has only been willing to contemplate it on a couple of occasions, actually in regard to the peace process, when Rabin and Barak, one or two other prime ministers, thought that maybe the security guarantee would be a way of selling painful concessions to the Israeli public, but not because they had a real strategic interest in it, and the Israeli national security establishment was always very much opposed to a formal security agreement because of fear that it would limit Israel's freedom of maneuver, the contractual requirement to consult, and also that the United States might demand that Israel divulge some of its capabilities, which it has not wanted to over the years. So I think this is an option which Israel may at some point be willing to discuss, but only when the other options have been exhausted. A second option, which is close to this first one of the American security commitment, is some sort of multilateral guarantee. It could be U.S.-Russian. It could be P5 in the Security Council. It could be some other multilateral one. It may add a little bit, but Israel is certainly going to be interested in an American guarantee, not in a multilateral one. So if it makes it a little bit easier for the U.S. to sell in multilateral terms, okay. But that's not the substantive point. The third option is the one I mentioned, an end to Israeli nuclear ambiguity. As I said before, I'm not sure this is an option that the U.S. wants to deal with. I'm not sure that Israel wants to. The context of Iran going nuclear might provide the pretext for both countries to change their policy on the issue, for Israel to decide to end ambiguity, for the U.S. to support an end to ambiguity. And if Israel were to end ambiguity and remove any lingering doubts that there may be regarding its capabilities, if it was also thought that Israel had a second strike capability, then, of course, there might be utility in doing this. At the same time, I believe that most of the world, including the Iranians today, believe that Israel is a nuclear power. I don't see the advantages to saying it openly. I can see only disadvantages, and my personal assessment is that it's unlikely that Israel will do so. Another option is regime change. Well, that option has only been out there since the Islamic regime came to power in 1979, and I'm not convinced that it's going to happen in the immediate future. I wouldn't hold my breath. In any event, if you look at the timeline towards nuclear development, at least as we saw it up to 24 hours ago, it was clear that the Iranians would be likely to achieve a nuclear capability way before there was regime change, so that wasn't a viable option either. Really, in the end, what it comes down to is either an American security guarantee of one sort or another. That's the only, I think, effective option. The bottom line is that on what may be arguably the most important issue the two countries have ever faced, a threat to Israel's existence, they may not really be able to discuss this issue openly. The study suggests a variety of means of trying to get by these obstacles, trying to discuss them. I don't think there's any really convincing suggestion there of how to do it. I think the obstacles are substantial. That isn't to say that it won't happen at some point. My concern is that it will happen too late for the two sides to be able to fully enjoy the benefit of close consultation. Tom Lear, the famous American satirist, political satirist, once said, he was talking about people who have trouble communicating, friends who can't talk to each other, couples who have trouble communicating, parents and children who can't communicate. He said, well, if you can't communicate, the least you can do is to shut up. I'm not convinced that that's the best way of going about it. Interpersonal relations, I certainly don't think it's the way that the United States and Israel should be handling their relationship. And so I think we should be talking about these issues. I'm not advocating which approach we should take, whether it's the military or the other options. I'm simply saying that we should be mapping out the options and we should be talking about them. If there is a failure to communicate, this can lead to miscalculations on both sides. It can lead the sides to take options which they might not pursue otherwise. Then the other side is left to deal with those options. They can be driven to what might otherwise be avoidable actions and policies. So I think talking is important, and I would hope, maybe now with some more time to do so properly, that the two sides can indeed do so. Thank you.